you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have John Q. Publius back on the show. Of course, he is the proprietor of the Anatomically Correct Banana and also the host of The Cocktail Hour, a weekly podcast. John, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, recently you've done a series on cultural subversion, focusing on this guy, Yuri Bezmenov, a Soviet defector who made all types of claims. I think the biggest part of that interview, Edgar Griffin, regarding cultural subversion and what the KGB was doing. Of course, cultural subversion, unfortunately, wasn't just a Soviet affair or KGB affair. It's much more, I guess it comes from both sides of the Iron Curtain, or primarily from the one side, actually, the West, really. Yuri Bezmenov, cultural subversion. What's all this about?
Well, the basic premise is, in order to colonize the country, he wrote a book under a pen name. I can't remember what he used for his alias, but he echoes some of the same sentiments that he talks about in his interview. But the KGB would use these tactics, and they are replicated throughout the world. Like you said, it's not just the KGB effect. We see it most prominently in the West. And ironically, the countries that were, at least in the European context, that were under Soviet rule, are the ones that are in best shape today, as far as the people themselves are concerned, and the demographics and all that. Although the birth rates are a bit low, but basically the idea was that he uses a quote from Sun Tzu to kind of serve as the launching point. And Sun Tzu talks about the fact that warfare, in the traditional military sense that we stereotypically think about it anyway, with armies, is the most crude form of warfare. That what you really want to do is basically colonize the brain of your opposition, and you want to discredit the ruling class if you're looking to overthrow them. Or you could, kind of as has happened here in the United States, sort of intermarry with them and sort of slowly supplant them through different means, to the point where the ruling elite is basically what's left of it. Their fate is inextricable from that of the kind of alien hostile group, or that's hostile to the native population. And it's basically a phasing out of the old, in our context, WASP elite, and in the new interlopers that came in mostly later in the 19th century and early 20th. And there are a number of strategies that you can use to consolidate power and to gain control. And in Bezmenov's context, it's mostly approached through the lens of trying to establish a communist type government. But we can see that it can be used very readily and as probably more effective, actually, as pertains to more neoliberal capitalist establishment. And some of those things are demoralizing the population. And we see that with all sorts of things from, privilege, guilt, and all these other things to even aspects of like pornography and other types of propaganda. And even the transgenderism thing, I would say, is a type of demoralization. He says basically you want to get to the point where you're in that you basically control the spine of the nation itself. Like you dictate how it moves. And so, like you said, he goes through a step-by-step process that delineates here is how one would ultimately consolidate power and take over. And I think it is a very, like I said, there are a lot of instances where it's in the particular communist context that I don't think are super useful to us with the way the ruling class seems to be headed. But the thing that a lot of people don't understand is that we're in kind of a hybrid model. The neoliberal model has elements of the capitalist system and has elements of kind of the, let's say more communistic or social system. But the idea is basically you privatize the profit and you make public the risk. So like in the bank bailouts, for example, the cost of all of the recklessness in the insider trading and everything else that had been going on in the subprime loans, that was all pushed on to the people, but all the profits accrued to the banks and the bankers, which is, ridiculous, obviously. But these kinds of things, this incessant propaganda war, and I would encourage, I'm going to reference Noam Chomsky, and the listeners probably want to kill me, but I would encourage people to read his Manufacturing Consent, where he talks about the role of he and his co-author. I can't remember the guy's name off the top of my head, but they talk about how propaganda is basically used to, like I said, manufacture consent, and how that is able to have an influence on people and their perception of things.
Yeah, I think his pen name was Thomas D. Schumann.
Yes, thank you.
Yep. And that book was Love Letter to America.
Yes.
I think he mentions four stages, I think, of this process. I believe it was destabilization, crisis, normalization, and... it was demoralization, destabilization, crisis, and normalization.
Yes. So basically the idea would be once you kind of get this, you bring things to a boiling point, and then when they sort of start to go tits up, I guess you could say, you can then bring in the strong hand, the iron hand, and kind of normalize a new state of centralized control. And again, Bezmenov speaking in the particular paradigm that he was in, I don't think, capitalism... Yes, it was rampant in the 1980s, but that was peanuts compared to what's happened after the turn of the century, as mm-hmm. far as the privatization of everything. So, I think,
we don't look at it as sort of a capitalist versus communist or left versus right phenomenon because of the cultural Marxist agenda is being used by capital to atomize and break down cultural resistance to their business model,
for lack of a better term. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And it's extremely insidious because they have all the hallmarks of the kind of Bolshevist, internationalism, but it's through that's being used for big capital. And again, the government's kind of, they're intermediaries where they need to be. They basically do everything in their power to enable corporate profit. It's run by and for corporations and financial institutions. It's prominent in Europe, but it's not as bad as it is here. A lot of the tyrannies in Europe are more state related. In my research, I've come to find, in the supranational governing bodies, EU and that kind of thing, they use a lot of the same tactics and strategies and things, but, the the site of where things are emanating from. You know, I think it's slightly different. Not that it doesn't happen, and not that it isn't a major factor in consideration, but it's more, at least in the United States, and it certainly will accelerate over there too, for sure, provided something isn't done. But yeah, that normalization, that becomes the new normal, the new status quo, is the kind of consolidation of power in this group. So if you can look at it in any number of different models, but one thing I was a massive red flag for me was, now I don't know all the ins and outs, full disclosure, of what's going on in Bolivia, but I had seen I've talked to a few people at basically the long and short of it that I've gotten, and I probably could have figured this anyway, but it was basically BS, you know, the official line we're getting. But I saw something that was like, Bolivia resumes diplomatic relations with Israel for the first time in over a decade or something. And I was like, oh, okay. I know all I need to know. Like, I know what's going on behind that. You know, it's like, come on.
Is the IMF involved in this too?
I think so. Yeah. I think it's a similar situation to like a Venezuela. But you just, okay. Yep. I see. They're just trying to bring them to heel. You know, but I think, to me, what's stuck out to me, I think, the most with Bezmenov, excuse me, was the demoralization factor, because I don't think many people are aware or aware enough of the way in which the kind of ruling class is trying to prime them and reduce their ability to resist what's coming. And in fact, to commodify every stage of the process too. So it's like you have, the idea of a person eating like maggot sausages and living in a, you know, people were saying on Twitter a couple months ago, like, I refuse to live in a pod and eat bugs, you know, that kind of thing. Like, I find that dehumanizing and demoralizing, and that's obviously by design. And they have a number of different, basically litmus tests to see what the population is willing to accept. And in my opinion, transgenderism is the ultimate one, because there are very few clear binaries in life like there are male and female. You know, there's a very small amount, I wouldn't say non-existent, but virtually non-existent, of like hermaphrodites or whatever the term is now. But the vast majority of people are either male or female. And if you can get people to accept that there are multitudinous genders and you can switch genders and whatever, you can basically get them to accept anything, right? So it's like that saying, in the absence of truth, anything is possible. Like, that's exactly the case. So the fact that they were able to, I would say they haven't fully, quote, won the cultural sphere as far as the transgender thing is concerned, but they're doing their damnedest to make that a thing. And you know, if they succeed with this, they pretty much can proceed with anything. And so that's to me another thing. And you know, there is of course a financial consideration, or they wouldn't do it. You know, the transgenderism thing too has a whole host of financial benefits that would accrue to them.
Interesting. If you talk about, you know, maggot burgers and living in a pod, there's sort of this scarcity based on, you know, environmental necessity. It's one of the things where in your meat, we can't sustain the large sections of the population eating meat because of the environmental concerns. And now you have some of this fake meat being marketed, like the Impossible Burger.
Yeah.
And I think it was Eric Stryker and Mike Enoch were talking about how this was like a Jewish conspiracy, kind of tongue in cheek, but not all tongue in cheek, because this is the forces of high finance trying to impose this false scarcity on people to accept it as the norm and as necessary. Same with pod living. It just, you know, eating meat is, you know, it's now not eating meat is becoming, you know, something like a moral statement, or it's the environment. Look at despite the fact that really very little impact on the environment is caused by meat production. And it doesn't say there aren't problems in how our food production system is currently, you know, arranged in mass production, things like that. But yeah, it's sort of this revolution of lower expectations. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And if you know, if their money was where their mouth was, they wouldn't be subsidizing the quadrupling of sub-Saharan Africa's population.
Yeah, why are they doing that? Yeah. At the same time, they're running up the debt. That itself is a form of asset stripping, which gets into the whole particulars of how the banking money system works and, usury and fractional reserve banking and, debased money currencies is a weapon or a tool for asset stripping as opposed to a store of value, which is what we're taught it is, which it isn't actually. It's a debt bond,
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, and I think the key here is that, and I've got a whole slew of pieces that I'm working on right now that kind of get into this. I have talked a bit about the climate change thing. I actually published a piece called Hashtag Squad Goals about the climate change thing on Occidental Observer. Basically, it's like, who's behind this so-called squad, and who are the financial interests and why are they pushing this ridiculous Green New Deal? Mm-hmm. What are the vested interests? It's very much of what you're talking about. And, there are a number of other considerations. For example, I kind of go into I touch on it in the piece, if I recall. I've written so much. It's like hard to keep it all straight. What's in what piece? But I do have an upcoming episode of The Cocktail Hour where I talk about this. But a lot of it, too, has to do with keeping male hormones low. And therefore, that causes a lot of sickness, disease, brain fog. It makes you less not hostile, but it makes you less aggressive, so less likely to actually object to your replacement in any capacity, let alone physical. So that's part of it as well.
Well, that's the we just ended November. November was supposedly No Nut November.
Yes, yes.
Where people were because they swore off pornography for the month, and I guess this is a recognition that. Pornography is indeed psychological warfare. It's a weapon used to make you make you easy to control. Weapon to control you, and I just was made aware of an article in Psychology Today, and also there's one in Rolling Stone, saying that actually not masturbating, not watching pornography makes you more aggressive, more fascist, if you will.
Well, there you go. See, yeah,
so they're exactly. Admitting. I mean, for those who make the accusation that pornography isn't freedom, it's slavery. The other side is making the point,
right?
So basically,
yeah, they're trying to do the same thing. They say like, oh, well, you shouldn't work out, too much because it could be bad for you. It's like, no, bad for you.
Yeah, yeah,
it's good for me.
Like eating meat, right? Because it gives you too much protein and makes you
right. Yeah. Exactly. And the thing is, the plant proteins, they're an inferior protein. You have to do all these things to get. To get the amino acids that you need, and their lower bioavailability, mm-hmm. and so you're not getting what you think you're getting, and it's the same crap, and it's like our natural testosterone's in the tank from all the plastics and the hormones mm-hmm. in the water and everything else, and then I suppose you could go to a doctor and get like over the counter hormone replacement, but they upsell you, like they overcharge you some ridiculous amount compared to what it should be. And, it was made, anabolic steroids, testosterone derivatives were perfectly legal in this country till Joe Biden led a campaign in 1990 to make them, I forget what schedule it is there, but to make them illegal basically. And so you can't even like try to counteract what they're unnaturally doing to you to balance it out to a more natural level in any kind of above board means without, paying an arm and a leg, four times what you should be paying for it. It's a joke.
Yeah, this is the environmental issue that Greta Thunberg isn't talking about.
Right, exactly. And, she's not talking about, in order to talk about all the plastics or any of the pollution and, that's mostly coming from India and China. And, it's really, the whole thing's a farce. The icing on the cake for me was Thunberg, I believe it was a Rothschild, like one of the Rothschilds racing yachts that they loaned her to. It's like, come on, people. How much more obvious can it get?
Then her crew was flown over and then she was flown back. So,
Right. It's like, yeah, it's absurd.
After the photo op, yeah.
After the photo op. I whenever I talk to people about it, I'm like, shouldn't she be in school, by the way? Isn't she like 15?
Yeah, yeah.
What's she doing gallivanting around in the United
Unfortunately,
Nations?
There's a lot of shoulds in her life, from what I understand. So,
yeah, fair enough.
I mean, she comes from the dystopia of Sweden. I guess in the whole problem going on in Sweden with depopulation replacement, not to mention the advanced feminism that's been imposed and break up with the family and the sort of the social engineering that's occurred during the past 40 years has turned to Sweden into the most depressed civilizations on the planet.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing too, and I don't think the average person is aware of what's happened there by any... Well, of course they're not aware of what's happened there at any stretch of the imagination, but they still have this stereotype of kind of like the blonde Swede, the sort of utopian. Mm-hmm. And you'll find it. You can find it in Sweden. I mean, it's a gorgeous country. But like, you know, it's like most places, the population is very urbanized by and large. And so it's very central control. And, you know, you go to some of these places and you don't see a whole lot of Swedes. I mean, it's the same as any, you know, or most Western countries. You go to the major cities and, you know, you could be anywhere.
Yeah, modernity makes you crazy. But they don't, once they're faced with the, you know, all the pathological behavior, they don't say, well, let's return to traditionalism. They just prescribe drugs.
Yeah, these drugs. And, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and I haven't checked whether or not this is true. So, you know, listeners, forgive me if this is inaccurate, but that there was, at the very least, there was a proposal for psychiatrists, if you met with one, to that it was going to be mandatory for them to prescribe you something. and I don't know if that is true or it's going to happen or it's been proposed or what. But none of the above would surprise me, obviously. You know, we're talking about a thoroughly over-medicated culture. I mean, it's really, you know, it's really gotten out of control. And it's, you know, it's not just the antidepressants and everything else, the opioids and, you know, these kinds of things. But again, all symptoms of something deeper that, you know, anyone outside of Tucker Carlson in the mainstream is just not talking about.
No.
You know, and I know a couple of people on our quote in our thing kind of poo-poo the guy. And I'm like, you know, he's doing the Lord's work compared to what anybody else is talking about. I mean, okay, maybe he's like, he doesn't want to talk about race beyond, you know, okay, it's unfair to treat people unequally. But, you know, the issues that he's bringing
to light. He dog whistles it, I think.
I mean, he
talked about that town of Pennsylvania being converted from 90% white to being 60%, you know, Hispanic in the course of, you know, 15 years.
And he's talking about Lewiston, Maine. He's talked about, you know, and so he does mention it. And I think, you know, we run into this issue where people are like, they want him to go full, I don't know, whatever. And it's like, you know, he's in a very precarious position as it is, but he's dispensing valuable information and insights. And there are very few mainstream people who even talk about demographics in any serious fashion beyond the officially approved narrative. I mean, I've Ann Coulter and Mark Stein or others that I've heard, but
that speech, a big business hates your family.
Yes. Yeah. You know, exactly.
And I don't know, when you're dealing with beltway conservatives or typical right wingers, they're like, "What? What are you, a communist?"
Right.
Exactly. That's the type of reaction you're often hear. Walmart's great. What are you talking about? You know, they don't. And so that just that approach to it, and talks about, you know, if we live in an economy where a man can't get a good job to support his wife and child, then this economy isn't any good. He said that, and that's, you know. Again, just goes in this speaks to the issue of cultural subversion, because cultural subversion is many things. It's multifaceted. It's not just producing media that corrupts your morals. It's also making an economy which you can't even, if you want to stay home and raise your kid, often you can't. That's when they talk about choice a lot. Women could choose to have a career, but they've gone about and made a situation where most women don't even have that choice, because the broader economic conditions don't allow for it, not to mention the cultural. And also many of the, you know, women themselves aren't suitable mothers anymore, and a lot of the men aren't suitable fathers because of the culture, you know.
Yeah, it's really gotten to the point where, and actually Tucker talked about Elizabeth Warren's book, The Two Income Trap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sad to see someone sell out to the degree that she has. Not that I probably would have agreed with her on much anyway beyond that, and the fact that, you know, at the very least, her rhetoric about Wall Street. But if you look at where she gets her money, it's obviously hot air. You know, but it's true. And you know, I think families could probably, if you really worked it, depending on your socioeconomic situation, you might be able to get it to like a job and a half. So the mom's just doing some like part-time stuff. But even then, it's like, So, I mean, she does talk about that, but, you know, some of the two income thing is a lot of it just perpetuates itself. You
well,
know?
It's consumption patterns. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, but the economic realities are such for a lot of people that even that's like beyond.
Well, a lot of that also gets into what you talk about with your previous articles about the weaponized migration and also forced integration and disruption of homogeneous communities. Because if you live in a community where there's high trust and your kids literally can run around. You don't have to worry about them. You're not going from place to place planning their day. So they don't get shot or beat up on the street or whatever, or worse, you know, because they do what kids used to do. They just go out and play, and run around and do your things. If not in school, they're out playing, and you know that the sort of the decay in of the public square and public life in the United States, you know, in the past 40, 50 years.
Yeah, and the economic realities make it so that you have to move and in many cases away from your hometown, away from your family, mm-hmm. so you can't have your parents look after the kid while you're doing stuff or, you know, that kind of thing. So it removes a whole support system that you would have had, and the kind of declining religiosity removes the church element that people would have had. And if you're atomized and don't really know your neighbors or trust your neighbors, then there's another one that's gone. So yeah, then now you have a whole industry of au pairs and daycares and everything else, and you once again it's just self-perpetuating system, and you make it so whites or particularly white families can't afford to have more than one or two, and you bring in the migration. And I've referenced this E. Raymond Hall quote a few times, but he says, you know, basically you won't find two biological organisms in the same area. I'm going to butcher the quote, but it's basically like two similar type organisms in the same area for long, more or less. So the idea that like you'll have this one population kind of horn in on another and basically replace them. And it goes into demoralization because demoralization artificially suppresses birth rates and can ultimately keep it down if you're not, you know, if things don't change. And hopefully I'll remember the exact quote, you know, pop back into my head. At some point when we're talking, so the idea there is you're going to have you're going to have a population that has the economic realities, and then there's the demoralization aspect. And you know, you might have people everything ranging from like, well, what's the point, we can't afford it, to, you know, what's the point, you know, life is terrible, and then you'll get the whole litany of excuses in between, the crime and the schools and everything else. And you know, the system is I've heard people describe it as anti-fragile. I would not say that it is anti-fragile, but I would say that it is deeply interconnected. I think it's actually extremely fragile, much more so, I think, than people realize. And, you know, I would love to be able to give it a kick over the cliff myself, but I think most probably what's going to happen is it's just going to collapse under its own weight, because it just is it's stretched too thin, and it relies on too many different interconnected things. And it has to always be growing and consuming, and it's going to run headlong into a brick wall at some point with something. And I don't know that we necessarily know what that's going to be, but I think that that's a key point to make.
Now, you talk about, of course, cultural subversion. This isn't sort of a social law of thermodynamics where things fall apart. There are agents that are actively working towards this subversion. For the purposes that Yuri Bezmenov talked about, I mean, you know, undermining the morale and moral fiber of the nation, particularly targeting the youth, because they can, with all in confidence, they know that the older generation will simply die off eventually. But if you can target the next generation, you know, through media, education, and these things, that you can pull off this revolution without ever firing a shot. When they've apparently done this, we've had the Cultural Revolution here in the United States. Over multiple generations, I was we're talking about you a few minutes ago you alluded to transgenderism. Of course, you had this weird stories of drag queen story hour in local libraries, and this doesn't just happen, of course. But, you know, people think the local library is your library, but it's part of the American Library Association, and it's a sort of a national organization, And I was listening to a talk show, and it was brought out that the American Library Association was, in the 1970s, taken over by his character, Israel David Fishman, who's a gay rights activist.
Oh, and my
God. He was the founder of the Task Force on Gay Liberation, and a section of the Social Responsibilities Roundtable. He succeeded in getting the task force to use the library, American Library Association, to spearhead gay rights. This is libraries.
Oh,
so we're wondering why this is happening. It turns out that a lot of these libraries are getting funding from, I think it was a Jewish family that owns a lot of Western timber concerns, and then also George Soros Open Society Foundation, I believe. I think George Soros is involved in one way or another. So it's not as if your local library is your library. It's being, again, being subverted by foundations and NGOs and these things. And some people jokingly refer to NGOs as non-Gentile organizations. So maybe we're getting to the group that a group of people that maybe are a group that may be responsible for this. This sort of cultural subversion is, yeah, it's corporate, it's financial, it's high finance, financialization, banking. Of course, when you talk about financialization banking, you immediately have to think of our Levantine friends, right?
Oh, of course, yes. I did not know. Wow, I did not know that about.
Yeah, I just heard about it today. I was recent. I'm not confirming that. I did quickly look him up, and that is indeed true. But it turns out if you dig deep enough, this is from above. You know, and it's being funded by these wealthy families of a certain persuasion, who have historically been, you know, involved in subversion, in revolution, and these things. So that's something. I mean, you know, again, it's people always say, sorry to say, but you know, hey, look, it's the Jews.
I mean, you can't get it. You know what? It's crazy. It's one of the. You know, what's funny is like the more.
I want to find Amish, but I can't find
it. You know. He tries, you know, and it's funny, the more you look into it, it's with a lot of things you kind of get, I mean, it is, Jim Goad calls it overdoing it. I think it is possible,
mm-hmm.
but by the same token, there is not one single issue that if you dig even a little bit into, you don't find them, if not primarily responsible for it, a major player in it. In some fashion. Mm-hmm. I mean, but so it doesn't, what you're saying, it's like, I'm saying, oh my God, because it's like, of course, like, of course, you know, of course. I just want to read I found the quote real quick. I'll read to you. E. Raymond Hall is a professor of biology at University of Kansas. He says, it is biological law that two subspecies of the same species do not occur in the same geographic area. To imagine one subspecies of man living together on equal terms for long with another subspecies is but wishful thinking and leads only to disaster and oblivion for one or the other. So, yeah, so the kind of the idea that, you know, one group will be, or groups at the moment will be ascendant and one will be kind of phased out, you know, and then presumably depends on how it all shakes out, you know, who takes preeminence and all that. But, you know, you read all these studies about, you know, white deaths by despair, which again, you know, it's, you want to talk about Jews, look at the opioid crisis, like the Sacklers.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
You recently had a show on that. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That was a great, because two guys I brought on, Emil Krapelin and Cakes for Kavanaugh. These guys, they've done some deep, deep research into that. Personally, it's not an area of expertise of mine, so you know I let them take it away. But yeah, you'll find again more of our old buddies there behind that, and specifically targeting whites. You know, on top of that, spending more money on veterans, on the elderly, and on whites in particular. You know, there de facto there are higher percentages of whites in those groups, but there's also I think I can't remember the exact quote, but. It was something like the prescriptions are going to be like a snowfall deep and white or something like that. So
yeah, they, of course, the veterans that are finding themselves addicted to these opioids are often got that addiction fighting a war for the sake of Israel. So
right, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just a cruel, cruel irony. You're right, and you know, it tends to be poor whites from places like, you know, Appalachia or. You know, rural areas that disproportionately go. So there's this whole meme that the media has tried to create of like, oh, poor blacks and Hispanics going off to fight in Vietnam and stuff. It's like, no, those would be like my family that got drafted and sent out there. Like, yes, there might have been some blacks and Hispanics. First of all, there were like no Hispanics in this country during that time period. I just say no, but not anywhere near the percentage that there are now. And okay, yeah, maybe plenty of blacks would have gone, but you know, it has and will hope, unfortunately, be for the foreseeable future, be whites that are motivated by, you know, in the absence of a draft, they're motivated by patriotism to go. But even then, it was like it was poor whites that were getting sent over there, you know. And I, you know, I'm not buying that they targeted blacks to send over to Vietnam in the draft. You know, I mean, again, there would have been a fair amount, but it's not like, you know, whites based on their race are excused from the draft. And like I said, by misguided notions of patriotism, they will enlist in far higher numbers and in per capita far higher, even today in the absence of a draft. So it's just ridiculous.
Well, I think that the disparity, I guess the difference, I guess, I think Jews in the military are like 0.3% or something.
Yeah. They're like underrepresented by a factor of five, I think. You know,
I guess that disparity is made up for in their domination of finance and banking.
Right. Of course. Yeah. It makes all the sense. I think they're like a third of the billionaires in this country.
Yeah.
It's like when people go, well, they have higher IQs. Oh, okay. So you acknowledge that there are racial differences in intelligence then. Whoa. It's like any way you want to try. And even if you did use that, like I saw Jordan Peterson had written a piece trying to kind of argue, he chooses the high end of their IQ figures. It still doesn't explain the per capita over representation. It simply doesn't.
But then they do exist as a group.
Right. Then they do, you know, and then it's based on things like merit and effort and hard work or IQ or all things that are denied for reasons why whites might be overrepresented in something. It's like, you people make me sick. But part of it too is the glaring double standard creates animosity, and it creates, like, they need to find ways for the people that they're not able to sufficiently demoralize. They have to find ways for that steam to be let off, or else, you know, they will find themselves in a particular predicament where people have gotten fed up and they're like, that's enough, you know, because if you're sufficiently demoralized or weak or sickly or all the above, you know, you're not going to rebel. You're not going to push back. You're not going to resort to any other means. And so they have to find a way to corral that. And where they can't commodify it with vice or corral it in some fashion, they need to have a safety valve or some kind of outlet. And you could see, I don't believe, quite honestly, that Donald Trump had been, I believe he's co-opted now, clearly. But when he first ran, I don't think that he was, and I think the establishment was legitimately nervous, that people were, you know, that their grip was loosening. Like, I don't buy him as a safety valve candidate. I think he is now. And I think the fact that they were able to hamstring his candidacy caused a lot of people to be demoralized as well. And so to see how, like, even the guy who was talking the talk and seemed to have all his ducks in a row and seemed like he was going to do good things for us was so quickly enfolded into the system and co-opted. You know, they still treat him like a boogeyman, but he's not. He's very much their tool. And, you know, I think that, you know, people use the slang kind of black pill, you know, and I think that was their post-election strategy to kind of kneecap him and co-opt him in any way that was possible. And that gets people disillusioned with the whole process, but they also kind of get this extra sense where they say, well, it's not just, okay, the whole system is rigged. Well, let's look for alternative methods. It's like, well, why bother? But they have different, you know, periodically they have had moments of panic, like a Pat Buchanan as well. And they've had to do everything in their power to get that under wraps. But, you know, as far as people banding together and acting, in trying to subvert the system or doing other things, you know, they need to try and make sure that those can be let out in any way that they can, so it doesn't reach a critical mass or a boiling point. So it's like, you know, getting people frustrated well, get involved in, you know, channel those sort of aggressive team instincts to sports or watch porn or, you know, other things like that. But they do have a problem on their hands as far as how they're going to figure out where this, and I do still think the anger is building, though a sufficient percentage of the population is demoralized and downtrodden. I think that there's a very large and growing percentage that's getting to the point where they're going, well, yeah, the whole system is corrupt. The whole thing needs to go. And so, like, the safety valves that they have built in, or the different things that they have used to sort of channel people's energies in different directions or destructive, even self-destructive means, they're going to have to figure something out, because it is going to reach a critical mass where people have had enough. And they say, well, the whole thing needs to just be swept aside. You know, and they're up against it, because their system only has so much time before it bottoms out as well. So I think, I had subconsciously borrowed this idea from Tom Kaczynski, I recognize that he's where I got the idea from. But the idea that, like, I think the reason they're accelerating so rapidly is because they know something that we don't, because all they really had to do to win was just run out the clock. They didn't have to get so extreme with the rhetoric. They didn't have to do all the things that they've really gone over the top with pushing the last 5 to 7 years. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there's something going on that we're really not privy to that's leading them to try and, like, force the end game. But the problem is that if you look at, say, Weimar Germany, they accelerated too quickly and the population had enough. Mm-hmm. And I think that they run that risk now. Like I said, I think the system will fall apart of its own volition, but I would rather us kind of cleanly sweep it aside, or as clean as can be, sooner rather than later, because that will mean less collateral damage. I mean, I'm under no illusion that there isn't going to be collateral damage and a whole hell of a lot, but the quicker and cleaner we can do it, the better.
Well, if you get them to stop being so extreme and understand some limits, but they don't understand limits.
No, they don't. I mean, that's the whole thing. It's like their whole deal is infinite growth. Mm-hmm. Like, infinite growth of everything, just more of everything always. And it's like, yeah, this just simply not, I'm not, like, totally against markets or anything. You know, but it's like basic stuff. Like, if you were really worried about the environment, then you would be less bullish on free trade and more about local sustainability. You know, really elementary things that humans live their lives with forever, basically, until very recently. And, you know, they have so much of what they're doing. They're like, oh, well, you know, we'll use alternative energies and all these other things. And it's like, well, the environmental impact of, like, the batteries and all these other things that go into the so-called alternative energy sources or the smart cars or whatever, you know, whatever it is, probably causes more havoc on the environment than the fossil fuels. And there's only a certain amount of fossil fuels. So they are running up against a clock, you know, as far as that's concerned too. So,
what are the, in terms of cultural subversion, what are the key areas that you see?
Well, I think, you know, you had alluded to the schools. I think that's huge. I think anything that kind of involves public sector unions tends to know where their bread is buttered. So they're going to kind of band together and create uniformity in wherever they're, you know, wherever they're concentrated. I'm not against unions in general. I think they're actually pretty important. But I think that the way that they're used, you know, like I said, in the public sector is something that's very dangerous and encourages a lot of, like, homogeneity and thinking. Any aspect that you have where you can target the young is very significant. So you sell the kids on all this stuff from as young an age as possible. I mean, you saw it first really pronounced in the universities, but it's trickled down to, you know, grade school, as we've seen with the drag queen business.
It's becoming criminal, yeah.
Yeah, becoming, it's really gotten, I mean, it's always been out of control, but it's really, really gotten out of control the last couple of years.
This is the importance of atomization, because in the past, if you had a community and some solidarity in that community, people would band together and more or less form a posse and mete out some real justice to some of the people that are doing it. Because if you were in a park and some kid some guy walked up and started saying some of the things they say to kids in schools, you justifiably punch him in the nose and have him arrested.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I mean, what was hilarious to me was when they were pushing the Heather Has Two Mommies stuff, mm-hmm. written by a Jew, by the way. And they're pushing it in Birmingham in England, and it was like the Muslim community and a legitimate community, you know, well, not legitimate.
There's solidarity.
But they have a community and a solid, right. And they push back against it. And they were like, oh God, you know, our pets are not doing what we tell them to do. I mean, like, you know, they throw accusations of racism and all, and I don't mean to sound sort of basic, like they are the real racist, but they do treat everyone like widgets that they can just kind of move around and they're interchangeable, and they're not. They're finding that out, and it was very delightful for me to watch that happen, like it blow up in their faces.
A good example of cultural subversion, because it's like a laboratory. It was Ireland. Ireland Nation is where in the 90s and the aughts, you had corporations go in there because of preferable taxes, and Google and some of these high tech firms came in and more or less have colonized the country. They more or less subvert the constitution using their economic clout, and they change the culture through social media to the point where Ireland can be transformed within, you know, as Yuri Bezmar would say, 20, 30 years, and carry out the cultural revolution to the point where now they have Jews throughout the government that are facilitating the importation of you know, people from Africa to dilute the native Irish population, and you have a cultural agenda being spearheaded to... Irish themselves would depopulate themselves when they're celebrating their own demise with abortion and homosexuality.
Yeah.
I think their prime minister's a gay Indian, you know?
Yes. Yeah. You know. I mean, and it's happened in lightning speed. I mean, quicker than anywhere else. You're right. You know, it's turned into a playground for the rich, and now it's one of the most quote liberal countries in the world. Mm-hmm. And who would have seen that coming? Like you said, 30 years ago, so Bezmenov does talk about, it's basically like a generational thing. So he says, if you're, you know, what you're witnessing now, you're pretty much only like whatever generation has been sufficiently brainwashed is effectively lost. And that is the generation or generations that will be in positions of power. So everything's going to be at a delay. So if you could successfully prevent the indoctrination of the youth upcoming and kind of allow them to pursue their natural inclinations, you know, just regular, the way things have always been, you're still going to have a delay of like 20 to 30 years of this stuff going on. Now that does not account for the fact that so many experience the stuff firsthand, and contrary to this nonsensical contact theory, they see, oh my God, this is not what you said it was. And we see people reacting against the censorship. We see people reacting to a lot of the social and cultural things, and particularly younger people, because they're not freighted with all the same guilt, because they've been, you know, they've not received, nor have most people, quite frankly. I don't think there's really been preferential treatment for whites in probably anyone's living memory. You know, it might have been sort of de facto because you had a more laissez-faire attitude, or a more meritocratic attitude, I should say. And so, you know, like you're going to have, if you're contrasting particular populations, okay, you'll have more whites, let's say, versus black. But, you know, these kinds of things, you know, the active disadvantaging of whites, I think there were some aspects, perhaps with affirmative action, before with certain hiring and preferential practices and for other groups and these kinds of things. I don't think it really hit the extremes though until fairly recently.
These things are more palatable if you're 85-90% of the population.
Yeah, and you go, okay, yeah. You know, like, you know, the you know, the black population, they were brought here against their will and they had a bad rap for a while. And I'm not saying I'm in favor of affirmative action, but you can see how a population could sort of rationalize it. And now you're in a position where I think it's like 40% of the black students at top universities get in via affirmative action, come straight from Africa. So it's like literally a racial quota. I mean, it was to begin, but let's be honest, but it's like nakedly a racial quota system that you're preferentially bringing in like immigrant, like people that are not from here. And you're just saying, oh, here's the legacy of slavery. Like, what are you talking about? This person like just came over here from Ghana or something. Like, it doesn't even make any sense. It's ridiculous. And you see all these fracture points too, where you get the Asian class action lawsuits, like, you know, you guys can't just discount us SAT points. Like, yeah, well, welcome to our world.
Yeah.
The other thing too is their group, they have so many competing interests. I call it the game of intersectional Jenga. Like eventually, you know, they have to keep pulling identity groups from the bottom and try to put them on the top. And there's this, always this jockeying for position. And, you know, again, eventually that could be another thing that brings their whole thing down. You know, you have Hispanics who hate blacks and, you know, blacks who hate Koreans. And, you know, it's like Koreans who hate everybody. You know, it's like, you know, they have all these interests that they have to manage. And then even within the Jewish community, you have kind of two or three factions. You kind of have pro-Zio faction, kind of more of a Dianne Feinstein type faction. And then you have kind of the more Larry David like cultural Jews, mm-hmm. who are not particularly political, or who you know, I guess you could say before, you got like the Ron Unz types here and there, or Stephen Miller, and you know, obviously everyone knows this in generality, there's going to be loads of exceptions, but even within, like I said, the Jewish community, you're going to have competing interests. And you can even see with the treatment of Israel, for example, how that takes shape. And it leads to some kind of strange bedfellows. And you have like really weird, you get these really weird situations where you have Ilhan Omar criticizing AIPAC on one hand, and then on the other hand, petitioning the American Powerlifting Association to let trannies compete, you know, and you're like, what is going on here? Like, this is so odd. You know, but I think she's shrewd enough, you know, and she basically can't read. I don't know if you saw, the whole testimony thing. I had to laugh because she was citing, and after criticizing AIPAC, she was citing an ADL report on white extremism. It was like, okay, so she's not intelligent, but she's shrewd. So she's shrewd enough to play the game and know where, kind of for the most part, where the bread is buttered, and what kind of things she could retreat behind or signal about.
And she can leverage her victim status because of the color of her skin, and even though, you know, she's from Somalia.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, she's sharp enough or instinctive enough to be able to do that. Like I said, I think she's basically illiterate. But so are, for all intents and purposes, like half the population. I mean, that's another, it's kind of a Marshall McLuhan thing, where he talks about the mediums, the message, but the kind of the idea of literacy in particular mediums and, you know, the idea of like the written word and people being literate in the traditional sense is sharply declining. And it's not just, you know, it's not even, it's obviously more pronounced in particular racial groups and whatever, but even in the white population, there's a sharp decline in literacy, which is very disconcerting because, you know, of the omnipresence of media. So kind of to going back, we said like other types of areas of cultural subversion, I think that's a huge one is the media. And an unexplored one, actually, that I've been talking a bit about and I'd like to get more into in my own writing. I haven't done enough research to get super, super into it, but, you know, all the ins and outs of it, for example, in the way that I have like the NGOs and stuff, but is the music industry. Mm-hmm. And music is, popular music is absolutely a form of propaganda.
And it's been absolutely dumbed down too. I mean, it's,
oh yeah, it's intolerable to listen to. And of course, we know, of course, who's behind the music industry, but I mean, as far as like all the details, the specific names and all that stuff,
is it oversimplification to say that cultural subversion is Jewish subversion?
No, I don't think so. to be perfectly honest with you, I don't think so.
So now I can't post this entire video on YouTube? Oh no.
I don't think I have an account on YouTube anymore. I don't even...
Sacha Baron Cohen called for the arrest of the tech companies. They don't censor more.
You got to be kidding me.
He was getting an award from the ADL. and who is the ADL to preach to anybody considering their origins, right? I mean, it's.
Yeah.
But he's, I mean, this is like, this is interesting. It suggests some sort of civil war, because I was thinking that, you know, Google and, you know, Facebook were all controlled, and why would it be posting threats or making threats in a speech, you know, if they didn't clamp down on hate speech, you know, even though that's no legal term, it's no definition, just whatever some group doesn't like. But it means that there might be some resistance within the tech company, because they're the ones that catch the heat for all the censorship, doing the bidding, you know, for these Jewish organizations. And really, it's a Jewish war on free speech, because, you know, they have no regard for it. It's very Talmudic, very cynical, you know. I repeat myself. But I mean, if you look at the history of cultural subversion in the United States and the Jewish role in this, I mean, there's a long history of this with Hollywood and the music industry itself, and their role in pornography, abortion, gay rights. There's a Jewish hand behind all these movements of cultural subversion. It's the American Psychological Association's declassification or removing homosexuality from the Diagnostic Statistical Manual in 1973 was a Jewish operation inside the APA. And it was a political move. And
of course,
you know, and so this is a big move towards a normalization of homosexuality in American culture. Then is promoted through the media, which they control, and the movies and Hollywood and TV shows and these things. And over the past 30, 40 years, not to mention their cultural agenda of even divorce, no fault divorce. The person who wrote the no fault divorce law in California that Ronald Reagan signed was a Jew. The abortion laws in New York and California, basically the laws of New York and California, took over the entire nation with the Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade. But the activism, you know, Bernard Nathanson writes about this, was, you know, overwhelmingly Jewish. It was a Jewish operation. You know.
Yeah, it's I don't think it's oversimplifying it to say, because mm-hmm. you could look at anything, like you said, Hartzeller, the breaking of the covenants, the DSM taking gender, whatever it was before, now it's gender dysphoria, but they reclassified it on whatever the most recent DSM was. I think it was called like gender identity disorder, I think, mm-hmm. is what it was originally called. So now gender dysphoria to sound more benign. And, you know, probably in the next version, it will be removed entirely. You know, the whole just sort of general gaslighting is a very Jewish thing. And, yeah, the kind of the Talmudic. I mean, I had read somewhere that I can't remember the exact source, but it was something like Jews are 8 times more likely than white Gentiles to be homosexual. Like the incidence rates are astronomically high in Judaism compared to for whites. And so this is another thing that we see pushed. I tweeted something out the other day. I found a story in Haaretz that was like a Shmuley Boteach's daughter has opened a kosher sex shop in Tel Aviv. And I was like, of course, you know, like, of course. It's like, of course. But it's just what they do. And the schooling thing, I mean, you look at the Frankfurt School, you know, Kevin MacDonald, you know, in his magnum opus, Cultural Critique, talks about anthropology and psychology and how they colonize those fields.
And look how psychology has been weaponized. I mean, this is right. Freud, oh, yeah. You know, and his nephew.
Yep. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you've got like the ADL training police. I think they've trained like definitely 20, 30,000. I'm sure probably even more police officers and like anti-bias training or whatever that is that they've got going there. You know, or how to recognize hate crimes. I don't know if you saw this. It was on, I think it was about 2 weeks ago. There was a new measure that was pushed through by Jews. Let me pull this up real quick. This is also from Haaretz. I don't even know if that's how you pronounce it, but I like to underscore the absurdity of the name. They have basically there's a new procedure for the newly established State Division of Human Rights and Hate Crimes Task Force, which has an endowment of several million dollars, and for how police officers in New York State can preemptively recognize hate crimes. And it says Let me see here. New York State police officers must be trained in how to recognize and respond to hate crimes under a new law. The bill comes as hate crimes in general and anti-Semitic incidents in particular are on the rise in New York City. Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the measure on Monday. Its chief sponsors are State Assemblywoman Nelly Rodzich of the New York City Borough of Queens and State Senator Todd Kominsky of Long Island, both Jewish lawmakers.
Yeah. And are these anti-Semitic incidents, are they real or are they just like people criticizing Jewish organizations? What do they consider anti-Semitic?
It says a string of assaults, but, you know.
Probably based on ADL or Southern Poverty Law Center files.
Right, yeah. Which, yeah, so anti-Semitism's on the rise, so give us more money. You know, so it's like, you know, it's, you know, this idea of like how to recognize and respond to hate crimes. So you're basically learning how to like preemptively recognize, oh, this is a hate crime. This was motivated by hate rather than, okay, here are the first of all, the idea of hate crime in general is like hate speech, another total construct.
Well, the Supreme Court has a rule that it doesn't exist in law.
Yeah, it's nothing. It's nothing. But you know, it's like, okay, so you arrive on the scene and someone got in a fight with someone else and like they're two different races. Okay, well, it has to be a hate crime therefore, you know, and, like, I don't know what training they need to identify that because that's just the calculus. Okay, there was a white person involved. They're guilty. I mean, like that's basically what it is at this point. So like what training that involves, I don't know, but saying like you walk onto a scene and you're basically pre-biasing the person, you're prejudicing the person towards this idea of a hate crime or something being racially motivated when the vast majority of at least crimes that whites are the perpetrators of are it's like not anything to do with that. I mean, it's usually the other way around when there are attacks or crimes committed on the basis of race. I think it's like 85% of them are directed against whites.
Yeah, if anything, yeah.
So if anything, right, and I don't even recognize it as a valid thing, and as you said, the Supreme Court doesn't either, you know, then this idea is just, it's preposterous, but it's just another layer of bureaucracy, another bit of immunity for Jews, you know, to kind of rely on this whole idea of the, well, anti-Semitism's on the rise and blah, 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 blah. But, yeah, you're relying on places like the ADL to chart hate and track hate and quantify. Like, how does one quantify hate, you know? And what constitutes anti-Semitism? You know, is it just being mildly critical of a Jew or what? Or even quoting things Jews have said as and repeating them is hate speech. I mean, in many cases, or anti-Semitic, in many cases, that's what we see. You just quote something they said, or, you know, I'm sure someone, I'm trying an experiment at the moment with my Twitter account. I'm just retweeting Jewish articles about Jewish issues without comment. And I'm wondering how long it will be till I get suspended or that's construed as anti-Semitism. I'm sure it won't be long.
Well, what they call anti-Semitism is... It's a reaction, quite often, to Jewish behavior, and it's not. And, you know, you just can't say, well, why are people critical or acting this way? You have to ask, what was done to, you know, to spark this behavior? And this is historically, you know, because of their control of the media, the manipulation of narratives, Jewish behavior was always taken out of the narrative, and you just see the reaction. And so if that's the way a story is told, yeah, it's always going to look bad. But, you know, if you look at the revolutionary period, you know, in Russia and in Germany in the 20s, even like you had Bela Kun in Hungary, you talk as cultural subversion, corruption, and there's a reaction. Same thing in Germany in the 20s and in the 30s. Even in the 30s, you had, was it, Judea declares war on Germany in March 1933. An economic boycott was declared against Germany by international Jewry. Now, if you turn around and you say there's international Jewry, just you're saying, what are you, a racist like Henry Ford?
Right.
But then how do they organize a boycott? You know, so it's one of these things where they exist and they don't exist, you know. And it's the same thing when you're talking about their culture influence in media and Hollywood, you know.
Yeah, there's that classic, and I use the term facetiously, article by Joel Klein, I think it is, mm-hmm. and Joel Stein or whatever,
I think it was Stein, Joel Stein.
Joel Stein's, and saying, like, who runs Hollywood? Come on. You know, and he points out, you know, of all the major movie studio heads and all this other stuff. And then, of course, he says, oh, well, you know, I talked to Abe Foxman, and Abe Foxman doesn't want me to emphasize this. He wants to present it like, you know, these are all people who just so happen to be Jewish. It's like, yes, of course. Just like crime-riddled areas. The crime just falls from heaven like manna, and it has no bearing on anything. It's like the idea of anti-Semitism, you're right, it's basically the cart is perpetually before the horse. Like, it's always, oh, this happened. It's like, okay, well, what did you do preceding that? Like, what from 19, if you, it's like in Germany, from 1917, let's say, to 1933, what were you doing that brought this about?
Yeah, Magnus Hirschfeld and the Weimar period, the, you know, what was going on in Germany. I mean, the traditional response, medieval Europe, I guess the Catholic Church had a thing called Sicut de Deus Non, you know, a doctrine which was, I think it was Pope Gregory the Great. And he's the one that, you know, basically it said that no one has the right to harm Jews or disrupt their worship services, but the Jews have likewise no right to corrupt the faith or morals of Christians or subvert Christian societies. Now, this is when there were Christian societies, you had integral societies. The one thing that makes America and the modern world so vulnerable is that they are now de facto liberal. They are pluralistic, and this is something the Jews themselves have worked hard to create, because they do very well in such societies when there's no ethno-religious consciousness. So at that time, you could lay down rules and recognize Jews as being alien. And I, you know, people say, what do you say that? Well, that's the essence of Zionism. The essence of Zionism, I think it was Theodor Herzl who said that the Jews are one people, and they are more loyal to Zionism or to the Jewish people than they are to the country they reside in, their host country. So inevitably, with that consciousness or that identity among Jews as being one people, whether it's Israel, manifest in Israel, or Israel everywhere they go, there is a question of dual loyalty, which I always say would be an improvement. But but they themselves create this question. So but if you live in an integral society, like if you had societies that were identifiably Christian, which America isn't, of course, but say Ireland was a good example. Ireland was a good example where it's a Catholic country, and to me, there should have been in place where you have to be a Catholic to be serving the government. But they became liberal. Now they allow, you know, gay Indians and Jewish justice officials who are actively working to erase Ireland off the face of the map, at least genetically, you know. Yep. And the same thing is occurring here in the United States. When people have done a lot of work, Andrew Joyce, about the prominent role the Jews play in these NGOs and other organizations, and also inside governments in bringing about the migration crisis or immigration or integration, internal integration, manipulating, sort of playing arbitrage with humanity, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, I'm obviously not on the same level as Joyce, but like if people went and, you know, wanted to read Anatomically Correct Banana or Occidental Observer, the pieces I've written about Maine, you can see a microcosm of how this works. You take it in, it is still the whitest state in this country. I think it's like 95% white. You take a homogeneous and culturally, I was going to say culturally homogenous, but not exactly, but let's say more or less culturally homogenous state as well, as like a microcosm, and you see, okay, well, who's doing what? Who's behind this? What are the main factors? Who are the major players? And you see a state that it's less than 1%, like Weimar Germany, around 1% or a little less than 1% of the population is Jewish, and they are behind the whole thing.
Yeah.
Like every single thing from the financial aspect to the NGOs, the social stuff, the activism through you know, quote unquote charitable giving through the Jewish federations, these donor advised funds, which are kind of the next frontier of philanthropic tyranny, as I call it, that is actually a Jewish concept. The first one was started in Boston, and it was pretty widespread in the Jewish community by the 20s and 30s. That's how they dispense funds to different organizations to further their agenda. You see the Jewish community of Portland, Maine, gets a lot of their funding from down in Boston, so it influences you know, the policies up there.
Didn't they also take over Catholic Charities?
Yeah, they basically, like, for all intents, so Catholic Charities,
or at least the part devoted to refugee relief or something, right?
Now. Yeah, basically how it works is like officially Catholic Charities is still intact. It's run in Maine by some guy from like Azerbaijan who's supposedly Christian. I don't know. But it's the funding for it, like the purse strings are basically controlled by the Jewish Federation. The one in Maine is basically controlled by the Jewish Federation in Boston. So huge section. So basically there's a loophole in the Refugee Resettlement Act, I think it was from 1980, where if a state opts out, the government can designate a private organization, the sole refugee resettlement organization in the state. So it's no longer under government purview, but it becomes basically privatized. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the previous governor of Maine did, thinking that there was like, okay, we're going to get out of this stupid thing. Not realizing that, it kicks in where it becomes privatized. So then the government can go, okay, we're going to turn it over to Catholic Charities then. So Catholic Charities runs it for the entire state of Maine and dispenses all the funds to who, to where, and whatnot. It's basically most of the money that goes in there. It's things like the United Way, which has a heavy Jewish influence, believe it or not. The Jewish organizations pair up with Catholic Charities, particularly, like I said, for the out-of-state money, because it's not a particularly wealthy place. They funnel the money into Catholic Charities, which then uses it kind of like, you know, politicians run and they get donations from corporations and they have to do what they say, basically. Same idea. And so they give the funds to Catholic Charities, who then disperses it out to these different organizations which have Jewish heads or have heavily Jewish involvement. And that facilitates, you know, and then they have corporate partners that they join up with, who also have a lot of Jews, or, you know, the immigration law firms, Jews, you know, mm-hmm. same idea. The whole interconnectedness of it, it's a symbiotic relationship. But a lot of it does come from the way they do with other things. They have the kind of Gentile front, and then they're either behind it or they're dispensing funds or that kind of thing. So technically they're not in control of it, but like basically they are.
Yeah. Yeah. And what you have here is you have the, you know, basically the greater Jewish organizations, whether it's the NGOs or even banking and finances. I understand that micro lending is playing a big part in migration, meaning they're providing the initial funds for people to spend $5,000-$6,000 on a plane fare and travel expenses, when ordinarily they just really couldn't pay for the transportation. What you have here again is a broader cultural subversion being carried out, you know, through banking, advertising, movies, entertainment, music, the prominent Jewish role in this cannot be denied. This isn't to say that every Jew is involved in this. This is self-evident. I know you don't have to say it, but the organizations that are involved are overwhelmingly Jewish or Jewish controlled, and that's something that one should take notice of, because it does support this interest that the Jewish people seem to have in breaking down homogeneous, integral societies and creating pluralistic, diverse societies where they can blend in. And that's, you know, Kevin McDonald writes about that sort of a survival mechanism. They have a survival strategy that they have. But also sort of a tendency for revolution. This is something E. Michael Jr. talks about. This is something that started at the foot of the cross when they rejected their Messiah. This is sort of a theological take on it, whereas Kevin McDonald has more of a, you know, evolutionary development of it. And how with the rejection of Christ, the Logos of the universe, they became revolutionaries. And it has reverberated throughout history in these things. And other Jews write about the prominent Jewish role in various reform and revolution movements. I think it was, Rabbi Lewis Newman in the 60s wrote a book about it and how the Jews were involved in every Christian reform or reformation movement. The heresies they were very involved in. They actually helped fund Cromwell's civil war against Charles I, and even the Enlightenment and so-called Enlightenment, the Russian Revolution, of course, the Civil Rights Movement. So Alexander Solzhenitsyn wrote about it in 200 Years Together. Yeah, I think the one book that hasn't been translated.
Right, yeah.
In English, for some strange reason. Hollywood's great. I mean, you know, there's good examples. Hollywood in the early part of the 20th century. And this is a good point to close the interview out on, because this gives an example of a counter when there's actually was some resistance to this. Was in the early part of the 20th century, there was very strong ethnic identity, and still in the United States, and particularly the Catholic ethnics. And this was it was the Catholic ethnics that pretty much imposed the production code in Hollywood in the 1930s. It was 1933. Joe Breen was a public relations executive who had established contacts with various American bishops and the Eucharistic Congress in 1924. And he met with A.H. Giannini, a Catholic banker.
Oh.
Bank of America. And this is when Hollywood was borrowing money from him. And Hollywood's at the time, he met with him, appealing to their mutual Catholicism to put a short leash on Hollywood. So some of the movies they're making, in the late 20s and 30s were very objectionable. This sparked this cry for production codes and laws, and they came to this agreement with the production code. And it was a boycott that was organized with Dennis Cardinal Daugherty of Philadelphia. And this is, of course, during the Depression. Hollywood had borrowed a lot of money to make talking films, I think. It was the cutting-edge technology at the time. In the late 20s, they developed that. And so they were over the barrel. And because they were able to organize boycotts in these various Catholic ethnic enclaves or neighborhoods, Hollywood listened. And again, the key to this is ethnic solidarity and consciousness. This was smashed in the 50s, 60s, and 70s through cultural subversion. But Joe Breen had this to say about Hollywood. They are simply a rotten bunch of vile people with no respect for anything beyond making of money. Here in Hollywood, we have paganism rampant, and it's the most virulent form. Drunkenness and debauchery are commonplace. Sexual perversion is rampant. Any number of our directors and stars are perverts. The Jews seem to think of nothing but money-making and sexual indulgence. The vilest kind of sin is a common indulgence hereabouts. And the men and women who engage in this sort of business are the men and women who decide what the film fare of the nation is to be. They, and they alone, make the decision. 95% of these folks are Jews of an Eastern European lineage. They are probably the scum of the earth.
All right.
So that's the difference, is that at that time, there was, again, enough confidence and consciousness, and also just knowledge of the of pretty much, what was going on, right? Basically, everyone kind of knew that society was in the constant state of kind of covert ethnic warfare. So it was a question of who had the power and flexing your muscle. And after World War II, that was kind of forgotten. We'd all become homogenized into all Americans, but one group didn't. And so that's the situation we're in today.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, everyone has to drop their swords and shields except for them, you know. And then, of course, they can weaponize particular groups to pick those up and advance, quote-unquote, their interests. Well, really, it's on behalf of the Jews, like with blacks, mm-hmm. And all the while maintaining that that intense in-group preference and furthering their means through that. And, I think it's not for nothing that it seems universal that wherever they go, they kind of bring they might try to couch it in terms of revolutionary movements, but there's nothing inherently positive in this so-called revolution that they bring. It usually is things to do with licentiousness and money lending. And again, all sorts of like corrupting things. It's never anything positive. It's one thing to have a group pursuing, and I think it's perfectly reasonable for every group to pursue their interests, but at the cost of corrupting and destroying others, I think is where the line needs to be drawn. I think it's very reasonable, and we should strive for every group getting their own homeland where they can determine their own destiny. But what is it in the Jewish psyche that makes them particularly drawn to perversion and degeneracy and pushing that on other people and indeed taking delight in it in addition to profit in many cases, probably a combination of Woody Michael Jones and Kevin McDonald.
Yeah.
have put forth, you know, and there's probably other elements too.
But. He traces it to some usury in finance versus like labor. And he says where labor actually adds value, usually in finance asset strips, it robs. It creates a situation where you have to, instead of your money making, it doesn't add to the common wealth, it actually detracts from it, because with usury and compound interest, there never is enough money to pay the debt off. And then you have to, again, foreclose on everything. And if you have a situation where you're loaning money, charging interest, that money doesn't even exist prior to the loan, then it really is dysfunctional. It's the situation we have today.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
System. Yeah. So I said I had you here for just a little over an hour. Anything else you want to talk about? Or?
I can't think of anything. I think we pretty much have gotten to all the essentials.
Great. So follow your website. It's the Anatomically Correct Banana?
Yes, yes. The anatomicallycorrectbanana.com. Silly name, hopefully memorable for that reason, primarily. Because you got a lot of good – I mean, the content on it is serious.
I know. It's good stuff. So.
But yeah, the name is so dumb. It's like, what in the world is this? So I've had a few people like, you need to change it. I'm like, it's too late now. You know, the die is cast. But yeah, you can read my stuff there.
But your podcast is a good – the Cocktail Hour.
Yeah, the Cocktail Hour is a good – good, classy, solid name, less silly. Those are really the major where you can find me for the most part. I mean, I'm here, there, and everywhere with some other stuff. I just published a piece on Defend Europa, on democracy. And you could find some other stuff on Occidental Observer and Arctos. But those are probably the go-tos, I would say, were Anatomically Correct Banana and Occidental Observer for the writing, and then the Cocktail Hour for podcast.
I just interviewed John Bruce Leonard on his new book.
Oh, fantastic.
Relatively new book.
Yeah. What's the name escapes me at the moment.
The New Prometheans.
Yes, thank you. I was going to say something to do with angels, but... kind of.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, no, he's incredibly intelligent. I love the Arctos stuff. It's really high-end stuff. It's a pleasure. I'm just excited in general with all the great minds we have in our thing, kind of talking about things seriously and offering real reasonable critiques. It's very refreshing. If you turn on the TV, you think this is like a total wasteland. But
I know. It's like you ever get stuck at a repair shop or a dentist office? Or no, usually it's an auto repair shop, but you're stuck watching what's on television.
Yeah, it's like, just... put me out of my misery. Yeah, it's just 12 different people on the screen screaming over each other, and you're like, what is this? You know, come on.
So, okay, well, I'll let you go. Let you remain your evening. Thanks a lot. If I don't talk to you between now and the new year, happy new year. Merry Christmas, happy new year.
Yes, thank you very much. You as well, and thank you for having me on again. I appreciate it.
You're certainly welcome. You have a good night then.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There'll be peace on earth, but instead it just kept on raining, a veil of tears for the virgin birth. I remember one Christmas morning, a winter's light and the distant choir, the peal of a bell and that Christmas tree smell, and eyes full of tinsel and fire. Dream of Christmas, they sold me a silent night.
They told me a fairy story till I believed in the Israelite. And I believed in Father Christmas. I looked to the sky with excited eyes. Then I woke with a yawn in the first light of dawn. And I saw him in through his disguise. I wish you a brave new year. All anguish, pain and sadness, lead your heart and let your road be clear. They said there'd be snow at Christmas. They said there'd be peace on earth. Hallelujah, Noel, be heavenly on hell. The Christmas we get we deserve.